curtains. Only the living room was bright. It had a big window that framed a section of light and sea, displaying it like a prized object. My daughters, I realized, moved through the entire apartment with more freedom than in their own house. They touched everything. They took what they wanted with never a reproach, and they spoke to the maid in the courteous but commanding tones they had learned from their grandmother. In the first hours after I arrived, they showed me their room. They wanted me to get excited about the many expensive toys that they would never have received from me and their father. They told me about the many wonderful things they had done and seen. I slowly realized that Dede had become very attached to her grandfather, while Elsa, although she had hugged and kissed me as much as she could, turned to Adele for anything she needed, or, when she was tired, climbed up on her lap and looked at me from there with a melancholy gaze, her thumb in her mouth. Had the children learned to do without me in so short a time? Or rather, were they exhausted by what they had seen and heard in the past months, and now, apprehensive of the swarm of disasters I conjured up, were afraid to take me back? I don't know. Certainly, I didn't dare to say immediately, "Pack your things and let's go." I stayed a few days. I began to care for them again, and my in-laws never interfered. Rather, at the first recourse to their authority against mine, especially by Dede, they withdrew, avoiding any conflict. Guido, in particular, was very careful to speak about other things. At first, he didn't even allude to the break between me and his son. After dinner, when Dede and Elsa went to bed, and he, politely, stayed with me for a while before shutting himself in his study to work late into the night, evidently Pietro did little more than apply his father's model, he was embarrassed. He usually took refuge in political talk, the deepening crisis of capitalism, the cure-all of austerity, the broadening area of marginalization, the earthquake in Friuli as the symbol of a precarious Italy, the great difficulties of the left, old parties and factions. But he did it without displaying any interest in my opinions, and I, in turn, made no effort to have any. If he actually decided to encourage me to say something, he fell back on my book, whose Italian edition I saw for the first time in that house. It was a slender volume, not very conspicuous, which arrived along with the many books and magazines that piled up continuously on the tables, waiting to be perused. One evening he asked some questions, and I, knowing that he hadn't read it and wouldn't, summarized for him the arguments, read him a few lines. In general, he listened seriously, attentive. In one case only did he offer some learned criticisms on a passage of Sophocles that I had cited inappropriately, and he assumed professorial tones that shamed me. He was a man who emanated authority, even though authority is a patina, and at times it doesn't take much to crack it, if only for a few minutes, and glimpse a less edifying person. At a mention of feminism, Guido's composure suddenly shattered, an unexpected malice appeared in his eyes, and he began to hum sarcastically, red in the face. He, who in general had an anemic complexion, a couple of slogans he had heard. Sex, sex behind the wall. Who has orgasms of us all? No one. And also, we're not machines for reproduction, but women fighting for liberation. He sang in a low voice and laughed, all excited. When he realized that he had unpleasantly surprised me, he grabbed his glasses, cleaned them carefully, withdrew to his study. On those few evenings, Adele was almost always silent. But I soon realized that both she and her husband were looking for a way to draw me out into the open. Since I wouldn't bite, my father-in-law finally confronted the problem in his own way. When Dede and Elsa said goodnight, he asked his granddaughters in a sort of good-humored ritual, "What is the name of these two lovely young ladies?"
"Dede. Elsa."
"And then, grandfather wants to hear the whole name."
"Dede Airota. Elsa Airota."
"Airota like who?"
"Like Papa."
"And also?"
"Like Grandpa."
"And what's Mama's name?"
"Elena Greco."
"And is your name Greco or Airota?"
"Airota."
"Bravo. Good night, dear ones. Sweet dreams."
Then, as soon as the children left the room, accompanied by Adele, he said, as if following a thread that started from the answers of the two children,
"I've learned that the break with Pietro is due to Nino Saratori."
I jumped. I nodded yes. He smiled. He began to praise Nino, but not with the absolute support of years earlier. He said that he was very intelligent, someone who knew what was what, but, he said, emphasizing the adversative conjunction, "he is fickle." And he repeated the word, as if to make sure that he had chosen the right one. Then he emphasized,
"I didn't like Saratore's most recent writings."
And in a suddenly contemptuous tone, he relegated him to the heap of those who considered it more urgent to make the gears of neocapitalism function, rather than to continue to demand transformations in social relations and in production. He used that language, but giving every word the substance of an insult. I couldn't bear it. I struggled to convince him that he was wrong. Adele returned just as I was citing the essays of Nino's that seemed to me most radical, and Guido listened to me, emitting the dull sound he usually resorted to when he was suspended between agreement and disagreement. I suddenly stopped, rather agitated. For a few minutes, my father-in-law seemed to soften his judgment.
"After all, it's difficult for all of us to orient ourselves in the chaos of the Italian crisis, and I can understand that young men like him find themselves in trouble, especially when they have a desire to act."
Then he rose to go to his study. But before he disappeared, he had a second thought. He paused in the doorway and uttered harshly,
"But there is doing and doing. Saratore is intelligence without traditions. He would rather be liked by those in charge than fight for an idea. He'll become a very useful technocrat."
And he broke off, but still he hesitated, as if he had something much crueler on the tip of his tongue. He confined himself, instead, to muttering goodnight and went into his study. I felt Adele's gaze on me. I ought to retreat, I thought. I have to make up an excuse, say I'm tired. But I hoped that Adele would find a conciliating phrase that might soothe me, and so I asked, "What does it mean that Nino is intelligence without traditions?" She looked at me ironically.
"That he's no one. And for a person who is no one to become someone is more important than anything else. The result is that this Signor Saratore is an unreliable person."
"I, too, am an intelligence without traditions." She smiled.
"Yes, you are, too. And, in fact, you are unreliable."
Silence. Adele had spoken serenely, as if the words had no emotional charge but were limited to recording the facts.
Still, I felt offended. "What do you mean?"
"That I trusted a son to you, and you didn't treat him honestly. If you wanted someone else, why did you marry him?"
"I didn't know I wanted someone else."
"You're lying."
I hesitated. I admitted, "I'm lying.
Yes. But why do you force me to give you a linear explanation? Linear explanations are almost always lies. You also spoke badly of Pietro. In fact, you supported me against him.
Were you lying?
No. I was really on your side. But within a pact that you should have respected.
What pact?
Remaining with your husband and children. You were an Airota. Your daughters were Airotas. I didn't want you to feel unsatisfied and unhappy. I tried to help you be a good mother and a good wife. But if the pact is broken, everything changes. From me and from my husband, you'll have nothing anymore. In fact, I'll take away everything I've given you. I took a deep breath. I tried to keep my voice calm, just as she continued to do. Adele, I said, I am Elena Greco, and my daughters are my daughters. I don't give a damn about you, Airotas. She nodded, pale, and her expression was now severe. It's obvious that you are Elena Greco. It's now far too obvious. But the children are my son's daughters, and we will not allow you to ruin them.
17. That was the first clash with my in-laws. Others followed, though they never reached such explicit contempt. Later, my in-laws confined themselves to demonstrating in every possible way that, if I insisted on being concerned with myself above all, I had to entrust Dede and Elsa to them. I resisted, naturally. There was not a day that I didn't get angry and decide to take my children away with me immediately, to Florence, to Milan, to Naples, anywhere, just so as not to leave them in that house a moment longer. But soon I would give in, put off my departure. Something always happened that bore witness against me. Nino, for example, telephoned, and, unable to refuse, I rushed to meet him wherever he wanted. And then, in Italy, too, the new book had begun to make a small wave. And although it was ignored by the reviewers of the big papers, it was nevertheless finding an audience. So often I added encounters with readers to the meetings with my lover, which extended the time that I was away from the children. I separated from them unwillingly. I felt their accusing gaze on me, and I suffered. And yet, already in the train, as I studied, as I prepared for some public discussion, as I imagined my meeting with Nino, an impudent joy began to bubble up inside me. I soon discovered that I was getting used to being happy and unhappy at the same time, as if that were the new, inevitable law of my life. When I returned to Genoa, I felt guilty. Dede and Elsa were now comfortable. They had school, friends, everything they wanted, independently of me. But as soon as I left, the guilt became a tedious obstacle. It weakened. I realized this, naturally, and the alternation made me wretched. It was humiliating to have to admit that a little fame and love for Nino could obscure Dede and Elsa. And yet it was so. The echo of Leela's phrase, "Think of the harm you're doing to your daughters," became in that period a sort of permanent epigraph that introduced unhappiness. I traveled. I was often in a new bed. Often I couldn't sleep. My mother's curses returned to mind and were mixed up with Leela's words. She and my friend, although they had always been, for me, the opposite of one another, in those nights often came together. Both were hostile, estranged from my new life. On the one hand, this seemed the proof that I had finally become an autonomous person. On the other, it made me feel alone, at the mercy of my troubles. I tried to repair relations with my sister-in-law, As usual, she showed herself to be very willing and organized an event in honor of my book at a bookstore in Milan. Most of those who came were women, and I was now much criticized, now much praised by opposing groups. At first, I was frightened, but Maria Rosa interceded with authority, and I discovered in myself an unsuspected capacity to summarize disagreement and agreement, choosing, in the meantime, a role as mediator. I was good at saying in a convincing way, "That isn't exactly what I meant." In the end, I was celebrated by everyone, especially by her. Afterward, I had dinner and stayed at her house. I found Franco there. I found Sylvia with her son, Mirko. The whole time, all I did was observe the child. I calculated that he must be 8, and register the physical resemblances to Nino, and even resemblances in personality. I had never told him that I knew about that child, and had decided that I never would. But all evening I talked to him, cuddled him, played with him, held him on my lap. In what disorder we lived. How many fragments of ourselves were scattered, as if to live were to explode into splinters. In Milan, there was this child. In Genoa, my daughters. In Naples, Albertino. I couldn't restrain myself. I began talking about that dispersion with Sylvia, with Maria Rosa, with Franco, assuming the attitude of a disillusioned thinker. In reality, I expected that my former boyfriend would, as usual, take over the conversation and arrange everything according to a skillful dialectic that settled the present and anticipated the future, reassuring us. But he was the true surprise of the evening. He spoke of the imminent end of a period that had been objectively, he used the adverb sarcastically, revolutionary, but that now, he said, was declining, was sweeping away all the categories that had served as a compass. "I don't think so," I objected, but only to provoke him. "In Italy, things are very lively and combative." "You don't think so because you're pleased with yourself."
"Not at all. I'm depressed."
"The depressed don't write books. People who are happy write. People who travel, are in love, and talk with the conviction that, one way or another, their words always go to the right place."
"Isn't that how it is?"
"No. Words rarely go to the right place. And if they do, it's only for a very brief time. Otherwise, they're useful for speaking nonsense, as now, or for pretending that everything is under control."
"Pretending? You, who have always kept everything under control, you were pretending?"
"Why not? It's unavoidable to pretend a little. We who wanted to enact the revolution were the ones who, even in the midst of chaos, were always inventing an order and pretending to know exactly how things were going."
"You're accusing yourself?"
"Yes. Good grammar, good syntax, an explanation ready for everything. And such great skill in logic. This derives from that and leads necessarily to that. The game is over."
"It doesn't work anymore?"
"Oh, it works very well. It's so comfortable never to be confused by anything. No infected bed sores, no wound without its stitches, no dark room that frightens you. Only that at a certain point, the trick no longer functions."
"Meaning what?"
"Blah, blah, blah, Lena. Blah, blah, blah. The meaning is leaving the words."
And he didn't stop there. He mocked what he had just said, making fun of himself and of me. Then he said,
"What a lot of nonsense I'm talking."
And he spent the rest of the evening listening to the three of us. It struck me that if in Sylvia, the terrible marks of violence had completely disappeared. In him, the beating suffered several years earlier had gradually exposed another body and another spirit. He got up often to go to the bathroom. He limped,
though not conspicuously. The purple socket, in which the false eye was clumsily set, seemed more combative than the other eye, which, although it was alive, seemed opaque with depression. Above all, both the pleasantly energetic Franco of long ago and the shadowy Franco of convalescence had disappeared. He seemed gently melancholy, capable of an affectionate cynicism. While Sylvia said that I should take my daughters back, and Maria Rosa said that, as long as I hadn't found a stable arrangement, Dede and Elsa were fine with their grandparents, Franco exaggerated his praise of my capacities, ironically defined as male, and insisted that I should continue to refine them without getting lost in female obligations. When I went to my room, I had trouble falling asleep. What was bad for my children? What was their good? And bad for me and my good, what did those consist of? And did they correspond to or diverge from what was bad and good for the children? That night, Nino faded into the background. Leela reemerged. Leela, alone, without the support of my mother. I felt the need to argue with her, shout at her, "Don't just criticize me. Take responsibility. Tell me what to do." Finally, I slept. The next day, I returned to Genoa and said point blank to Dede and Elsa in the presence of my in-laws, "Girls, I have a lot of work at the moment. In a few days, I have to leave again, and then again and again. Do you want to come with me, or stay with your grandparents?" Even today, as I write that question, I'm ashamed. First, Dede, and then, right afterward, Elsa answered, "With Grandma and Grandpa, but come back whenever you can, and bring us presents." 18. It took me more than 2 years, filled with joys, torments, nasty surprises, and agonizing mediations, to put some order into my life. Meanwhile, although I was privately suffering, publicly I continued to be successful. The scant 100 pages I had written to make a good impression on Nino were translated into German and English. My book of 10 years earlier reappeared in both France and Italy, and I began writing again for newspapers and journals. My name and my physical person gradually reacquired their modest fame. The days became crowded, as they had been in the past. I gained the interest, and at times the respect, of people who at the time were well known on the public stage. But what helped my self-confidence was some gossip from the director of the Milan publishing house, who had liked me from the start. One evening, when I was having dinner with him to talk about my publishing future, but also, I have to say, to propose a collection of Nino's essays, he revealed that, the preceding Christmas, Adele had pressured him to block the publication of my book. He said, jokingly, "The Airotas are used to plotting the rise of an undersecretary at breakfast and deposing a minister at dinner, but with your book they didn't succeed. The volume was ready, and we sent it to the printer." According to him, my mother-in-law was also behind the meager number of reviews in the Italian press. As a result, if the book had nevertheless made a name for itself, certainly the credit should go not to kind second thoughts from Dottoressa Airota, but to the force of my writing. Thus I learned that this time I owed nothing to Adele, although she continued to tell me I did whenever I went to Genoa. That gave me confidence, made me proud. I was finally convinced that the period of my dependence was over. Leela didn't notice at all. She, from the depths of the neighborhood, from that area that now seemed to me infinitesimal
continued to consider me an appendage of hers.
From Pietro, she got the telephone number in Genoa, and she began to use it without worrying about annoying my in-laws. When she managed to reach me, she pretended not to notice my terseness and talked for both of us, without pause. She talked about Enzo, about work, about her son, who was doing well in school, about Carmen, about Antonio. When I wasn't there, she persisted in telephoning with neurotic perseverance, enabling Adele, who wrote in a notebook the calls that came for me, putting down, I don't know, such and such month, such and such day, Satatore, 3 calls, Cerullo, 9 calls, to complain about the nuisance I caused. I tried to convince Leela that if they said I wasn't there, it was pointless to insist, that the house in Genoa wasn't my house, and that she was embarrassing me. Useless. She went so far as to call Nino. It's hard to say how things really went. He was embarrassed. He made light of it. He was afraid of saying something that would irritate me. Early on, he told me that Leela had telephoned Eleonora's house repeatedly, angering her. Then I gathered that she had tried to get him on the phone at Via Duomo directly. Finally, that he himself had hastened to track her down to prevent her from constantly telephoning his wife. Whatever had happened, the fact was that Leela had forced him to meet her. Not alone, however. Nino was immediately eager to explain that she had come with Carmen, since it was Carmen, mainly Carmen, who urgently needed to get in touch with me. I listened to the account of the meeting without emotion. First, Leela had wanted to know in detail how I behaved in public when I talked about my books, what dress I wore, how I did my hair and my makeup, if I was shy, if I was entertaining, if I read, if I improvised. Otherwise, she was silent. She had left the field to Carmen. So it turned out that all that eagerness to talk to me had to do with Pasquale. Through her own channels, Carmen had found out that Nadia Galliani had fled to safety abroad, and so she wanted to ask a favor again, that I get in touch with my high school teacher to ask her if Pasquale, too, was safe. Carmen had exclaimed a couple of times, I don't want the children of the rich people to get out, and not the ones like my brother. Then she had urged him to let me know, as if she herself considered her worry about Pasquale to be an indictable crime that could involve me too, that if I wanted to help her, I shouldn't use the telephone either to get in touch with the professor or to get in touch with her. Nino concluded, both Carmen and Leela are imprudent. Better to let it go. They can get you in trouble. I thought that, a few months earlier, an encounter between Nino and Leela, even in the presence of Carmen, would have alarmed me. Now I was discovering instead that it left me indifferent. Evidently, I was now so sure of Nino's love that, although I couldn't rule out that she wanted to take him away from me, it seemed impossible that she could succeed. I caressed his cheek. I said, amused, "Don't you get into trouble, please. How is it that you never have a free moment, and now you've found the time for this?" 19. I noted for the first time during that period the rigidity of the perimeter that Leela had established for herself. She was less and less interested in what happened outside the neighborhood. If she became excited by something whose dimensions were not merely local, it was because it concerned people she had known since childhood. Even her work, as far as I knew, interested her only within a very narrow radius. Enzo occasionally had to spend time in Milan or Turin. Not Leela. She had never moved. And I only began to notice that closing off of herself seriously when my own taste for travel intensified. I took every possible opportunity to travel outside of Italy at the time, especially if it was possible to do so with Nino. For example, when the small German publisher who had brought out my little book organized a promotional tour in West Germany and Austria, Nino canceled all his engagements and acted as my cheerful and obedient driver. We traveled all over for some 2 weeks, gliding from one landscape to the next, as if beside paintings with dazzling colors. Every mountain or lake or city or monument entered our life as a couple, only to become part of the pleasure of being there, at that moment. And it always seemed like a refined contribution to our happiness. Even when rude reality intervened and frightened us, because it corresponded to the darkest words that I uttered night after night in front of radical audiences, we recounted the fear to each other afterward, as if it had been a pleasant adventure. One night, when we were driving back to the hotel, the police stopped us. The German language, in the dark, in the mouths of men in uniform, guns in hand, sounded, both to my ear and to Nino's, sinister. The police pulled us out of the car and separated us. I ended up yelling in one car, Nino in another. We were reunited in a small room, left to ourselves, then brutally questioned. Documents, reason for our stay, job. On one wall there was a long row of photos, grim faces, mostly bearded, some women with short hair. I surprised myself by looking anxiously for the faces of Pasquale and Nadia. I didn't find them. We were released at dawn, returned to the place where we had been forced to leave our car. No one apologized. We had an Italian license plate. We were Italians. The check was obligatory. I was surprised by my instinct to seek in Germany, among the mugshots of criminals all over the world, that of the very person who was then close to Lila's heart. Pasquale Peluso, that night, seemed to me a sort of rocket launched from the narrow space in which Lila had enclosed herself to remind me, in my much broader space, of her presence in the whirlwind of planetary events. For a few seconds, Carmen's brother became the point of contact between her diminishing world and my expanding world. On the evenings when I talked about my book in foreign cities I knew nothing about, there was a host of questions on the harshness of the political climate, and I got by with generic phrases that in essence rotated around the word repress. As a fiction writer, I felt obliged to be imaginative. No space is spared, I said. A steamroller is moving from land to land, from west to east, to put the whole planet in order, the workers to work, the unemployed to waste away, the starving to perish, the intellectuals to speak nonsense, blacks to be black, women to be women. But at times, I felt the need to say something truer, genuine, my own. And I told the story of Pasquale in all its tragic stages, from childhood to the choice of a clandestine life. I didn't know how to make more concrete speeches. The vocabulary was what I had appropriated 10 years earlier, and I felt that the words had meaning only when I connected them to certain facts of the neighborhood, for it was only old, worn-out material of certain effect. What's more, if at the time of my first book, I had sooner or later ended by appealing to revolution, as that seemed to be the general feeling, now I avoided the word. Nino had begun to find it naive. From him, I was learning the complexity of politics, and I was more cautious. I resorted, rather, to the formula, to rebel is just, and immediately afterward added that it was necessary to broaden the consensus, that the state would last longer than we had imagined, that it was urgent to learn to govern. I wasn't always satisfied with myself on those evenings. In some cases, it seemed to me that I lowered my tone only to make Nino happy. As he sat listening to me in smoky rooms, among beautiful foreigners who were my age or younger. Often I couldn't resist and I overdid it, indulging the old obscure impulse that in the past had pushed me to argue with Pietro. It happened mainly when I had an audience of women who had read my book and expected cutting remarks. "We must be careful not to become policemen of ourselves," I said then. "The struggle is to the last drop of blood and will end only when we win." Nino teased me afterward. He said that I always had to exaggerate, and we laughed together. Some nights I curled up next to him and tried to explain myself to myself. I confessed that I liked subversive words, words that denounce the compromises of the parties and the violence of the state. "Politics," I said. "Politics, the way you think about it, as it certainly is, bores me. I leave it to you. I'm not made for that sort of engagement." But then I had second thoughts and added that I didn't feel cut out either for the other sort of engagement that I had forced myself into in the past, dragging the children along with me. The threatening shouts of the demonstrators frightened me, as did the aggressive fringes, the armed gangs, the dead on the streets, the revolutionary hatred of everything. "I have to speak in public," I confessed, "and I don't know what I am. I don't know to what point I seriously believe what I say." Now, with Nino, I seemed able to put into words the most secret feelings, even things I didn't say to myself, even the incongruities, the acts of cowardice. He was so sure of himself, solid. He had detailed opinions about everything. I felt as if I had pasted onto the chaotic rebellion of childhood neat cards bearing phrases suited to making a good impression. At a conference in Bologna, we were part of a determined exodus headed to the City of Freedom. We ran into constant police checks and were stopped at least 5 times. Weapons leveled against us, out of the car, documents, there, against the wall. I was frightened at the time, even more than in Germany. It was my land. It was my language. I became anxious. I wanted to be silent, to obey. And instead, I began to shout. I slipped into dialect without realizing it. I unloaded insults at the police for pushing me rudely. Fear and rage were mixed up, and often I couldn't control either one. Nino instead remained calm. He joked with the policemen, humored them, calmed me. For him, only the two of us counted. "Remember that we're here now, together," he said. "The rest is background, and will change." 20. We were always moving in those years. We wanted to be present, observe, study, understand, argue, bear witness, and most of all, love each other. The wailing police sirens, the checkpoints, the crack of helicopter blades, the murdered, all were paving stones on which we marked the time of our relationship, the weeks, the months, the first year, and then a year and a half. Starting from the night when, in the house in Florence, I had gone to Nino in his room. It was then that, we said to each other, our true life had begun. And what we called true life was that impression of miraculous splendor that never abandoned us, even when everyday horrors took the stage. We were in Rome in the days following the kidnapping of Aldo Moro. I had joined Nino, who was to discuss a book by a Neapolitan colleague on southern politics and geography. Very little was said about the volume, while there was a lot of argument about Moro, the head of the Christian Democrats. Part of the audience rose up, scaring me, when Nino said it was Moro himself who threw mud at the state, who embodied its worst aspects, who created the conditions for the birth of the Red Brigades, and thus obscured uncomfortable truths about his corrupt party, and indeed identified it with the state to avoid every accusation and every punishment. Even when he concluded that defending the institutions meant not hiding their misdeeds but making them transparent, without omissions, efficient, capable of justice in every nerve center, the people didn't calm down, and insults flew. I saw Nino turn pale, and I dragged him away as soon as possible. We took refuge in us, as if in shining armor. The times had that rhythm. Things went badly for me, too, one evening in Ferrara. Moro's body had been found a little more than a month earlier, and I let slip a description of his kidnappers as murderers. It was always difficult with words. My audience required that I calibrate them according to the current usage of the radical left, and I was very careful. But often I would get excited, and then I made pronouncements with no filters. Murderers did not sit well with that audience. The fascists are the murderers. And I was attacked, criticized, jeered. I was silent. How I suffered in situations where approval suddenly vanished. I lost confidence. I felt dragged down to my origins. I felt politically incapable. I felt I was a woman who would have been better off not opening her mouth, and for a while I avoided every occasion of public confrontation. If one murders someone, is one not a murderer? The evening ended unpleasantly. Nino nearly came to blows with someone at the back of the room. But even in that situation, only the return to the two of us counted. That's how it was. If we were together, there was no critic who could truly touch us. In fact, we became arrogant. Nothing else made sense except our opinions. We hurried to dinner, to good food, wine, sex. We wanted only to hold each other, cling to each other. 21. The first cold shower arrived at the end of 1978, from Leela, naturally. It was the end of a series of unpleasant events that began in mid-October, when Pietro, returning from the university, was openly attacked by a couple of kids, reds, black shirts, who knew anymore, armed with clubs. I hurried to the hospital, convinced that I would find him more depressed than ever. Instead, in spite of his bandaged head and a black eye, he was cheerful. He greeted me with a conciliatory tone, then he forgot about me, and talked the whole time with some of his students, among whom a very pretty girl was conspicuous. When most of them left, she sat next to him, on the edge of the bed, and took one of his hands. She wore a white turtleneck sweater and a blue miniskirt, and her brown hair hung down her back. I was polite. I asked her about her studies. She said she had two more exams before getting her degree, but she was already working on her thesis on Cthulhus. She's very good, Pietro praised her. Her name was Doriana, and the whole time we were in the ward, she only let go of his hand to rearrange the pillows. That night, in the house in Florence, my mother-in-law appeared with Dede and Elsa. I talked to her about the girl. She smiled with satisfaction. She knew about her son's relationship. She said, "You left him. What did you expect?" The next day, we all went together to the hospital. Dede and Elsa were immediately charmed by Doriana, by her necklaces and bracelets. They paid little attention to either their father or me. They went out to the courtyard to play with her and their grandmother. A new phase has begun, I said to myself, and I cautiously tested the ground with Pietro. Even before the beating, his visits to his daughters had decreased, and now I understood why. I asked him about the girl. He talked about her, as he knew how to do, with devotion. I asked, will she come to live with you? He said that it was too soon. He didn't know. But yes, maybe so. We have to discuss the children, I said. He agreed. As soon as possible, I took up this new situation with Adele. She must have thought that I wanted to complain, but I explained that I wasn't unhappy about it. My problem was the children. What do you mean? She asked, alarmed. Until now, I've left them with you out of necessity, and because I thought that Pietro needed to resettle himself. But now that he has a life of his own, things have changed. I, too, have the right to some stability. And so? I'll take a house in Naples and move there with my daughters. We had a violent quarrel. She was very attached to the girls and didn't trust leaving them to me. She accused me of being too self-absorbed to take care of them properly. She insinuated that setting up house with a stranger, she meant Nino, when you have two female children, was a very serious imprudence. Finally, she swore that she would never allow her grandchildren to grow up in a disorderly city like Naples. We shouted insults. She brought up my mother. Her son must have told her about the terrible scene in Florence. When you have to go away, who will you leave them with? Her? I'll leave them with whoever I like. I don't want Dede and Elsa to have any contact with people who are out of control, I answered. In all these years, I believed that you were the mother figure I'd always felt the need for. I was wrong. My mother is better than you. 22. I subsequently brought up the subject again with Pietro, and it became evident that, despite his protests, he would agree to whatever arrangement allowed him to be with Doriana as much as possible. At that point, I went to Naples to talk to Nino. I didn't want to reduce such a delicate moment to a phone call. I stayed in the apartment on Via Duomo, as I had often done now. I knew that he was still living there. It was his home. And although I always had a sense of temporariness and the dirty sheets annoyed me, I was glad to see him, and I went there willingly. When I told him that I was ready to move with my daughters, he had a real explosion of joy. We celebrated. He promised to find us an apartment as soon as possible. He wanted to take on all the inevitable annoyances. I was relieved. After so much running around and traveling and pain and pleasure, it was time to settle down. Now I had some money. I would get some from Pietro for the children's maintenance, and I was about to sign a favorable contract for a new book. I felt that I was finally an adult, with a growing reputation, in a state in which returning to Naples could be an exciting risk and fruitful for my work. But mainly, I wished to live with Nino. How lovely it was to walk with him, meet his friends, talk, come home late. I wanted to find a light-filled house with a view of the sea. My daughters mustn't feel the lack of the comforts of Genoa. I avoided calling Lila and telling her my decision. I assumed that she would inevitably get mixed up in my affairs, and I didn't want her to. Instead, I called Carmen, with whom in the past year I had established a good relationship. To please her, I had met Nadia's brother, Armando, who, I had discovered, was now, besides a doctor, a prominent member of the Proletarian Democracy Party. He had treated me with great respect. He had praised my last book. insisting that I come and talk about it somewhere in the city. Had brought me to a popular radio station he had founded. There, in the most wretched disorder, he had interviewed me. But as for what he ironically called my recurrent curiosity about his sister, he had been evasive. He said that Nadia was well, that she had gone on a long trip with their mother, and nothing else. About Pasquale, he knew nothing, nor was he interested in knowing. People like him, he had said emphatically, had been the ruin of an extraordinary political period. To Carmen, obviously, I had given a toned-down report of that meeting, but she was unhappy just the same. A decorous unhappiness, which in the end had led me to see her occasionally when I went to Naples. I felt in her an anguish that I understood. Pasquale was our Pasquale. We both loved him, whatever he had done or was doing. Of him, I now had a drifting, fragmentary memory. The time we had been together at the neighborhood library. The time of the fight in Piazza dei Martiri. The time he had come in the car to take me to Lila. The time he had showed up at my house in Florence with Nadia. Carmen, on the other hand, I felt as more consistent. Her suffering as a child, I had a clear memory of her father's arrest, was welded to her suffering for her brother, to the tenacity with which she tried to watch over his fate. If she had once been only the childhood friend who had ended up behind the counter in the Karachi's new grocery store thanks to Lila, now she was a person I saw willingly and was fond of. We met in a coffee shop on Via Duomo. The place was dark, and we sat near the street door. I told her in detail about my plans. I knew she would talk to Lila, and I thought, that's as it should be. Carmen, wearing dark colors, with her dark complexion, listened attentively and without interrupting. I felt frivolous in my elegant outfit, talking about Nino and my desire to live in a nice house. At a certain point, she looked at the clock, announced, Lena's coming. That made me nervous. I had a date with her, not with Lila. I looked in turn at the clock and said, I have to go. Wait, 5 minutes and she'll be here. She began to speak of her with affection and gratitude. Lila took care of her friends. Lila took care of everyone, her parents, her brother, even Stefano. Lila had helped Antonio find an apartment and had become very friendly with the German woman he had married. Lila intended to set up her own computer business. Lila was sincere. She was rich. She was generous. If you were in trouble, she reached into her purse. Lila was ready to help Pasquale in any way. Ah, she said, Lenu, how lucky you two are to have always been so close. How I envied you. And I seemed to hear in her voice, to recognize in a movement of her hand, the tones, the gestures of our friend. I thought again of Alfonso. I remembered my impression that he, a male, resembled Lila even in his features. Was the neighborhood settling in her, finding its direction? I'm going, I said. Wait a minute. Lila has something important to tell you. You tell me. No, it's up to her. I waited, with growing reluctance. Finally, Lila arrived. This time, she had paid much more attention to her looks than when I'd seen her in Piazza Amedeo, and I had to acknowledge that, if she wanted, she could still be very beautiful. She exclaimed, So, you've decided to return to Naples? Yes. And you tell Carmen, but not me?
I would have told you.
Do your parents know?
No.
And Elisa?
Not her either.
Your mother's not well.
What's wrong?
She has a cough, but she won't go to the doctor.
I became restless, I turned to look at the clock.
Carmen says you have something important to tell me. It's not a nice thing.
Go ahead.
I asked Antonio to follow Nino.
I jumped.
Follow in what sense?
See what he does.
Why? I did it for your own good.
I'll worry about my own good.
Leela glanced at Carmen as if to get her support. Then she turned back to me.
If you act like that, I'll shut up. I don't want you to feel offended again.
I'm not offended. Go on.
She looked me straight in the eye and revealed, in curt phrases, in Italian, that Nino had never left his wife, that he continued to live with her and his son, that as a reward, he had been named just recently the director of an important research institute financed by the bank that his father-in-law headed. She concluded gravely.
Did you know?
I shook my head.
No.
If you don't believe me, let's go see him, and I'll repeat everything to his face, word for word, just as I told you now.
I waved a hand to let her know there was no need.
I believe you,
I whispered, but to avoid her eyes, I looked out the door, at the street. Meanwhile, from very far away, came Carmen's voice saying,
If you're going to Nino, I want to come too. The three of us will settle things properly.
I felt her lightly touching my arm to get my attention. As small girls, we had read photo romances in the garden next to the church and had felt the same urge to help the heroine when she was in trouble. Now, surely, she had the same feeling of solidarity of those days, but with the gravity of today, and it was a genuine feeling brought on by a wrong that was not fictional, but real.
Leela, on the other hand, had always scorned such reading, and there was no doubt that at that moment she was sitting across from me with other motives. I imagined that she felt satisfied, as Antonio too must have been when he discovered Nino's falseness. I saw that she and Carmen exchanged a look, a sort of mute consultation, as if to make a decision. It was a long moment.
No, I read on Carmen's lips, and that breath was accompanied by an imperceptible shaking of her head.
No to what?
Leela stared at me again, her mouth half open. As usual, she was taking on the job of sticking a pin in my heart, not to stop it, but to make it beat harder. Her eyes were narrowed, her broad forehead wrinkled. She waited for my reaction. She wanted me to scream, weep, hand myself over to her. I said softly, I really have to go now. 23. I cut Leela out of everything that followed. I was hurt. Not because she had revealed that for more than 2 years Nino had been telling me lies about the state of his marriage, but because she had succeeded in proving to me what, in fact, she had said from the start, that my choice was mistaken, that I was stupid. A few hours later, I met Nino, but I acted as if nothing were wrong. I limited myself only to avoiding his embraces. I was swallowed up by bitterness. I spent the whole night with my eyes wide open. The desire to cling to that long male body was ruined. The next day, he wanted to take me to see an apartment on Via Tasso, and I agreed when he said,
If you like it, don't worry about the rent. I'll take care of it. I'm about to get a position that will resolve all our financial problems.
But that night, I couldn't take it anymore, and I exploded. We were in the apartment on Via Duomo, and his friend, as usual, wasn't there. I said to him, Tomorrow, I'd like to see Eleonora.
He looked at me in bewilderment.
Why?
I have to talk to her. I want to know